Accession number 3864, reel 2.
Major Logan, reel 2.
You were talking to me about recruitment, and you told me that some of the recruits were from Zulu tribes.
Yes, the Zulus in Chaka's day, towards the end of the 19th century, invaded Nyasaland, and a lot of their Zulu impis were left behind, probably to keep law and order to the Zulu code, and intermarried, stayed there, and from them is descended one or two tribes. The only tribe I can remember definitely were the Yao, who we recruited from. I think we recruited others as well, but I can't quite remember the name now. And they were naturally, having been descended from Zulus, who were historically the best fighting race in Africa, were good soldiers. They had a certain area of their own, because each tribe had its own area, territory, and they were distinguished by having cuts given at a very early age across their faces, merely a tribal mark, so it was very easy to recognize one of this tribe straight away. There could be no chance of anyone mistaking him for anybody else, or anyone else trying to pretend that they were Yaos.
What would happen to the Yaos when they were brought to the depot for training?
Well, having been given their kit and shown army life, they would be trained in the use of a rifle and possibly later on a light machine gun, taught rudimentary drill, and the general basics of soldiering life, what discipline and be instructed in what they could and couldn't do, and of course including the history of the regiment itself. One must remember that they would come there not like a British soldier, knowing the traditions and obviously a lot of history of the British Army. They would come knowing absolutely nothing at all, except that they knew roughly, I suppose, what the life of a soldier was like, and were usually very anxious to be soldiers, and so would therefore be both docile and keen, which is an ideal combination for a recruit anyway.
Who supervised the training?
All the training was supervised both by British officers and by British NCOs, and helped often quite considerably by African NCOs, sergeants, possibly warrant officers. The African warrant officers was, of course, invaluable in the early stages, because they would know far better than any of us did how much was necessary. In other words, what these people needed to be taught in the early stages. Some tribes, some men would be more intelligent than others and would need different handling. And how to do that was only really known by an African warrant officer.
What was your role as lieutenant in this
My role would be to be in charge of, say, about 30 Africans, with a couple of British NCOs to help me, and probably a couple of African NCOs. And we would see through the training of these 30 recruits from the day they arrived until they were considered qualified and competent basic soldiers. They could shoot with their rifles, they could drill, they knew how to carry out basic maneuvers. In other words, when they joined their trained battalions, they would know what to do, although they had much more to learn, but they would fit into the organization.
How did they adapt to using rifles?
Very well. The mechanics of a rifle are pretty simple. They would have no difficulty with that. They usually made very good shots. Their eyesight is absolutely excellent, far better than most Europeans. And they would be as good as British troops with the rifle as long as they were not under stress. When I say under stress, I mean at deliberate target shooting, they would often be extremely good at an early stage. If required to carry out rapid fire, in other words, fire a large number of shots in a short time, they would have more apt than the British to get fast until they learnt their job, or a thing like snap shooting where you suddenly put up a target from behind cover and they have to shoot at it. They would not be so good at that, and they would take longer to learn, that's all. Otherwise, after that, they would be just as good.
What form were they given any form of field training?
Yes, they were given exactly the same sort of field training, how to act in a section, which is the smallest unit in the British Army, usually about one NCO, a lance corporal, and say around about 7 men, up to a platoon of about 30 men, and learn how to carry out advancing, retreating, digging trenches, how to operate in camp and look after themselves, everything like that.
How was discipline maintained?
This was maintained in exactly the same way as in the British Army and in the same style. The punishments were exactly the same. And as a British soldier, and not exceeded. In other words, he'd get, say, 3 days CB or be given a court-martial sentence of imprisonment under exactly the same traditions as the British soldier. Discipline is easy to keep with African soldiers because they are, I think, a disciplined race, and that original tribal areas, discipline within the tribe is extremely strict. That would be administered locally by the village headman, who would stand no nonsense from the young men whatsoever, so they would come amenable to accepting orders, because the punishment they would get from their own people would be infinitely harsher than anything they ever got from the British.
What was your impression of the African NCOs who helped you in training?
they were keen on their job, but they needed rather a lot of supervision, because I think an African, especially in those days where their education was not very good, lacked the determination to keep up a standard. If he got tired, he would behave rather like an African would in his own village. He'd be out in the field having something to do. If he was tired, he'd sit down under a tree and do nothing and then carry on. And that sort of attitude was liable to occur. And they did not like responsibility to a great extent. again, especially in those days, they would like to, they liked the feel of having a British trained NCO somewhere near to back them up if they felt they needed more advice or having a little trouble with their squad, something like that. But they could, of course, be extremely good.
Were many of the Askari married?
Yes, a great many of them. They all marriage is a very natural state to them from an early age, as soon as they can afford a wife. And I think most of the Askaris at the depot in Zomba were married. I cannot quite remember whether, I don't think that recruits arrived from the bush with the recruiting team with wives. I doubt it. They probably acquired them later on, after they'd done some more basic training.
Did they have to ask permission to get married?
Yes, but it was very easily given. I can't remember any instance in which it was refused. There must have been some very exceptional reason.
Did they live in married quarters?
Yes, they lived just as they would have done in an African village, in round thatched huts, except that in the army the huts were in straight lines and they had married quarter lines, which of course every army has to make it easier to see what goes on. They would live a perfectly natural family life there with their wives and children, and their cooking and everything else would all be done in the lines on their own.
What was their diet?
Their basic diet was maize meal with some vegetables and meat. Of course, in their own village life, meat is a very scarce thing because the cows are usually kept for milk. And they don't kill their milk cows for meat. There's no such thing as beef on the hoof. So they had a few sheep and goats. But on the whole, they would have to go out in natural state and kill it themselves. And that is not so easy. And so therefore, it was one of the attractions of army life, was a regular ration of meat.
And their food would be cooked by their wives?
Yes, it would.
What was your diet, European officers?
The diet in the mess was almost exactly the same as it would be in England. As I said, they would buy it from the local store, and in Zomba and other larger towns in Nyasaland, the local store was always called Mandala Stores. It was all run by the same firm, just as in West Africa, Lever Brothers run all the stores there, and they're called Kingsway. And I once asked why they were called Mandala Stores, and I was told that one of the first men, Europeans, to start a European store in Nyasaland wore spectacles, and the natives did not understand this at all. And the word mandala means looking through water, man looking through water, which of course glass in front of their eyes was the only sort of relation they could make with it, never having seen glass before in those days.
Who would supervise the arrangements for buying food from the mandala?
They would be bought by the head mess boy, mess waiter, head waiter, but he would be very closely supervised by a European officer detailed for the job. We all had given the jobs of messing officer, wines officer, and were responsible for, say, 3 months of supervising all this, and you were responsible for the money spent. And the supervision was necessary. But without your African mess head waiter, you would suffer very badly, of course, when buying vegetables in the native store or fruit local, anything local, chickens, eggs. You could not do without him because you would be cheated. In a small way, yourself, and then the boy himself would not be probably.
Who did the cooking?
Yeah, we had regular cooks employed by the mess, who would almost always be civilians, and were not army. There was nothing like the army catering corps in those days, and in Africa, of course, anywhere else.
What was your basic diet?
Our basic diet was exactly the same as in England, really, except a lot of it would be imported. The meat would probably be local, some of the fish, the vegetables, and all that, but bacon and things like that would, and quite a lot of meat and ham or anything like that, would all be imported and would have been almost certainly bought from the mandala stores.
What was your accommodation like?
The officer's accommodation, I think, was the same as it was in India. You had a bungalow, probably brick and thatched, which was divided into two or three sections, and each officer would have his own bedroom and his own sitting room. You'd very likely share a bathroom, which would just be a tub of water, probably.
What was the standard of comfort like?
Very primitive, indeed. You would get the normal chairs and beds, all of which would be fairly rough, and you did have electric light, but there were no luxuries whatsoever. But as most of us were young men, we didn't mind that at all.
Once the training of the recruits was up, what happened to them then?
They were then dispatched in batches with their wives and children, if any, up to the 1st Battalion, which at that time was stationed in Moshi in Tanganyika. Moshi is fairly near the Kenya border, and Mount Kilimanjaro, which is the most magnificent site with its snow-covered top, it was about 19 miles away. We got there by going in our three lorries, which is all we had in Nyasaland, ferried us, I think, to the bottom, the south end of Lake Nyasa. We then boarded a steamer, I guess I can't remember whether it was a paddle steamer or not, and we did the trip up to the northern end of this very long lake. Its exact mileage, again, I cannot remember, but it took us several hours. I think we went on through the night. And at the other end, the landing facilities were almost nil. It was just a rough wooden pier, and it took us a long time to get all the askaris and the kit and the women and children off the boat. And I think we had to ferry them across the river, which ran into the northern end of the lake, or an offshoot of the lake in rafts or small boats. Anyway, it took a long time, and I got a severe rocket for taking so long from the transport officer who'd brought all the lorries down from Moshi to take us up from there. And as a very heavy thunderstorm flooded the road and his lorries and delayed us a considerable time. And he had his revenge on us by making the askaris I'd brought up with me pull with ropes these two or three dozen lorries up a small hill to get them out of the flood. We then, I should mention the fact that I had a private car in Zomba, which was, I couldn't take that in the boat with me, of course, and it was driven round the lake, quite a long journey, it must have been over 100 miles or more, by my African batman servant, who was a civilian. And he drove very well, met me at that northern end of the lake, and we then, the convoy got itself sorted out. We brought up the rear in my civilian car and all these army lorries and full of women and children and various hangers-on. It was a somewhat strange and unmilitary-looking convoy that went up the long way to Meshi. And I think our only adventure once we got going was the fact that one of the wives of this guy, who was obviously highly pregnant, gave birth to her baby in the back of the lorry. And I was rather flummoxed by this, but in typical African style, they can deal with any natural emergency with great speed and efficiency. Somebody came along from somewhere and knew exactly what to do, and the baby was safely delivered. And mother and child soon afterwards parked on the local district officer who was instructed to look after her and send her up when fit and well. And she later arrived by some civilian means in the Meshi with the baby. I should add that I was rather brutal. I didn't understand about babies much. The father of the baby asked me a very reasonable question, if he could stay with his wife and child. And I rather brutally said, no, you can't, because I've been told to produce 100 or 50, whatever it was, askaris at Meshi, or heaven help me. And so I said, no, I have a minus one without you, you come with us. Showing the discipline was rather good. He didn't demur any further and came with us. But I've always felt rather sorry about this. But it all ended happily.
So, you arrived in Meshi.
Yes, we did. We did. And these now trained, more or less, soldiers were then dispatched to various companies to which they'd been allotted before they arrived, and joined in the regular life of a proper trained infantry battalion.
You found the atmosphere in Meshi somewhat different than at Zomba.
It was completely different, because we, being a battalion of probably around about 600 men with many more British officers than there were in the depot in Zomba, and the fact that they were trained, they were carrying out much more interesting manoeuvres and were much more in the military picture in East Africa. Life was considerably better. And Tanganyika, of course, was rather more civilized, although not very civilized area, with many more Europeans of different types, including a lot of Germans.
What was garrison? Can you describe to me daily life at the garrison town of Meshi?
I've never thought of it as a garrison town. We were a garrison. Meshi was a very small town, probably no larger than Zomba, with just a few shops, the usual store, and of course the usual club, which was the centre of social life there, as everywhere else. There, of course, the language was Swahili. Once you get north of Nyasaland, the lingua franca is Swahili, which covers Tanganyika, Kenya, and a certain area of Uganda. anyway, all the Uganda skies will talk and understand Swahili. So therefore it is much more lingua franca than Chinyanja, which is only spoken in Nyasaland. But if you were with a battalion of Nyasa men, you would talk to them in their own language, Chinyanja, but locally nobody would understand it at all. You would have to talk Swahili. So therefore there was another language to learn.
Did this restrict contact between your troops and the local natives at Moshi?
No. Africans are extremely good at picking up any other language as long as there's a basic resemblance. They would not pick up French or German so easily. They will pick up another African language at enormous speed. They have, because they have very good hearing, and they have extremely good memories, because they, those days, could not usually write. And therefore, memory was essential.
How easy did you find it to pick up Swahili?
I found Swahili easier to learn than Chinyanja, because in India I had learned a little Hindustani. And it is Hindustani is Urdu, is based on a lot of Arabic words. Swahili is based on a lot of Arabic, because it was the language used by the Arab traders who came over from other parts and traded along the coast of Africa and penetrated inland, and of course ran the slave trade, so that their language was understood in a sort of pidgin type of way, of Arabic, really.
Did you have much contact with local African civilians?
No, we didn't, because local African civilians in those days were always of a pretty lowly status. And you would go to their shops and buy things and have that sort of relationship with them. There was no social relationship whatsoever, because none of them had anything like the basic social upbringing which would make it possible at all.
What were relations like between the European officers and their African troops?
They were always very good. We always treated them extremely well. The British Army has been famous for treating its troops very well, which is always why they've been successful with troops from any other nation, like the Indian Army. And wherever we have recruited and trained soldiers, because there's a basic, very basic human understanding and wish to get on well. And Africa has an enormous sense of humor. And